Part 1. A Life of Struggle. Chapter 1. Country Bumpkin. On April 27, 1822, Ulysses S. Grant was born in Point Pleasant, Ohio, tucked away in the rural southwestern corner of the state near Cincinnati. The tiny, boxy house, constructed of wood and painted white, stood a short stroll from the Ohio River, with Kentucky clearly visible on the far shore. Under its slanting roof, the residence was humble, consisting of a single open room with a fireplace. Point Pleasant was little more than a nondescript cluster of makeshift cabins overlooking bustling river traffic. Delivered by a stern-faced, bearded abolitionist, Dr. John Rogers, the plump baby weighed in at 10¾ pounds, with reddish-brown hair and blue-gray eyes. For many weeks, his father, Jesse Root Grant, and mother, Hannah Simpson Grant, conferred with relatives to find a suitable name for the hefty infant. The choices bandied about suggest a literate clan with high expectations for the child. Hannah opted for Albert to honor Thomas Jefferson's Treasury Secretary, Albert Gallatin, while her father opted for Hiram as a handsome, biblical name. Hannah's stepmother evinced enthusiastic admiration for the ancient commander Ulysses, recalled Jesse Grant, and urged that the babe should be named Ulysses. Some accounts claim the matter was settled by plucking names from a hat. Whatever the case, the family agreed on Hiram Ulysses Grant, which translated into the unfortunate initials H-U-G. The boy would show a decided preference for Ulysses and gradually discard Hiram, especially when other boys teased him about his initials. But this didn't halt the taunts, since Grant was known as Ulysse or Lys, soon bastardized by malicious schoolmates into Useless Grant. The name Ulysses S. Grant was the product of a later bureaucratic error that stuck. Jesse Grant worked as a foreman at the tannery just up the hill. At 6 feet tall, he was a large, imposing man, always considerably taller than his son, with broad shoulders and a florid complexion, who wore his silk hat low over large golden spectacles. He was a bumptious type common in small towns on the American frontier, a self-assertive windbag and congenital striver, brimming with schemes and bright ideas. Voluble and opinionated, he delighted in verbal combat. With his brusque manner and sharp-elbowed style, he went through life brawling with people in business and politics. Smart and enterprising, he kept a sharp eye on the main chance. One neighbor sneered he would follow a dollar to hell, and his business success and self-promotion tended to gall more modest people. Jesse proudly traced his ancestry to two early Puritan settlers, Matthew and Priscilla Grant, who emigrated from Dorset County in England and arrived in Dorchester, Massachusetts in 1630. "My family is American," Ulysses later declared proudly, "and has been for generations in all its branches, direct and collateral." Before long, Matthew and his son Samuel, traveling south to Connecticut, helped settle the town of Windsor on the Connecticut River. While Matthew served as town clerk and surveyor, his male descendants were strongly drawn to arms. One of them, Noah Grant, fought and died in the French and Indian War along with his brother Solomon. As a confirmed abolitionist, Jesse Root Grant delighted in showing off an original muster roll made out by Captain Noah Grant in 1755 that bore the words Prince, Negro, and Jupiter, Negro, as company members. Far more controversial was the military record of Jesse's own father, another Noah Grant. In his memoirs, Ulysses credited this Noah Grant with having fought in the Revolutionary War from Bunker Hill to the fall of Yorktown. Unfortunately, no biographer has been able to unearth documentary evidence to substantiate this wartime service. What seems certain is that Noah Grant's life went sadly awry. During the war, he married and fathered two children before becoming a widower. Then, afterward, he moved to western Pennsylvania, just east of Pittsburgh, where he married Rachel Kelly, a capable housewife who bore him several children, including Jesse. They ultimately moved to Deerfield, Ohio. When Rachel died in 1805, Noah was saddled with seven children from two marriages. His father was born rich and died poor, Jesse maintained, because the long period of soldiering spoiled him for all financial business. Ironically, the charge Jesse later leveled at his eldest son. After his wife's death, Noah took to drink, depleting an ample inheritance. In Jesse's words, his father lost something of his self-control and acquired the fondness for stimulants, a fact worth flagging because of the hereditary component in alcoholism. As a result, Jesse Root Grant had to support himself from age 11, while the younger children were farmed out to relatives and neighbors. Jesse developed a robust streak of independence, defining himself in contrast to his shiftless, alcoholic father, and showing a chronic zeal for self-improvement. After working as a farmhand for 3 years, Jesse performed chores for an Ohio Supreme Court judge, George Todd, whose family showed unusual kindness to the talkative young man. Finding Jesse illiterate, Mrs. Todd tutored him, taught him to read, and even paid for the only 5 months of schooling he ever enjoyed. For someone largely self-taught, Jesse was remarkably articulate, but he smarted from a sense of his deficient education and crammed in 4 weeks of English grammar lessons right after his marriage. So graciously had the Todds treated him that Jesse forever regarded them with all the reverence he could have felt if they had been parents instead of benefactors, Ulysses noted. Mrs. Todd encouraged Jesse's ambitions, fostered his love of reading, and urged him to cultivate a marketable trade. Determined to master tanning, a lucrative business at a time when people needed bridles and saddles, Jesse apprenticed with his older half-brother Peter, who owned a tannery in Maysville, Kentucky. One is struck by how quickly the headstrong Jesse Grant latched onto his calling. He was never one to squander time or dither over decisions. Quite courageously, Peter Grant headed the local abolitionist society, denouncing slavery as the blot which stains our government. During his Maysville stay, Jesse beheld the corrupting effects of slavery and later chided his Kentucky and Virginia relatives for depending too much on slave labor to be trained in self-reliance. The depth of his anti-slavery convictions prompted him to leave Kentucky when his apprenticeship expired. "I would not own slaves, and I would not live where there were slaves and not own them." His next job came in an Ohio tannery owned by Owen Brown, father of militant abolitionist John Brown. Jesse resided in the Brown household and came to admire John's purity of character and physical courage, but later faulted him for being a fanatic and extremist in whatever he advocated. After hanging out the shingle for his own tannery in Ravenna, Ohio, Jesse contracted a debilitating fever and ague that forced him to discontinue business briefly before going to work at the Point Pleasant tannery. Full of vim and drive, Jesse searched for a worthy partner and found her in the pious, frugal Hannah Simpson, who was almost 5 years his junior when they married in June 1821. She had grown up outside Philadelphia, the third child of John Simpson, a farmer who had uprooted his family and moved to southwest Ohio 2 years earlier. The Simpsons owned a substantial amount of land, and some neighbors saw Hannah as marrying down. "At the time of our marriage, Mrs. Grant was an unpretending country girl, handsome but not vain," Jesse wrote, boasting that the Methodist Episcopal Church had never had a more devoted and consistent member. As if intent upon monopolizing all future marital discussions, Jesse had tracked down a bride as thrifty with words as he was loquacious. He never stopped talking, while Hannah never started. An early photo shows the bearded Jesse bristling with irrepressible energy, his big fists resting on his thighs, while the self-effacing Hannah sits small and strangely placid beside him, a quiet woman withdrawn behind her spectacles and content to be so. Slim and erect, she was quietly refined and never called attention to herself, displaying an unbending sense of duty toward God, family, and country. Blessed with grit, she possessed all the domestic talents, from milking cows to baking cookies, required of a small-town bride. It seems crystal clear that Ulysses S. Grant modeled himself after his mutely subdued mother, avoiding his father's bombast and internalizing her humility and self-control. The unflappable Hannah spoke in a low voice, never swore, and remained calm and sweet-tempered. She was kind and solicitous toward neighborhood children. One of Ulysses's friends remembered her as a woman of deep feeling, but not demonstrative. Her reserve so resolute that she seldom joked and never laughed. Ulysses later praised her as the best woman he had ever known, unselfish, devoted to her family, thoroughly good, conscientious, intelligent, of a quiet and amiable disposition, never meddling with other persons' affairs, genuinely pious without any cant, with a strong sense of right and justice. He attributed his good sense and moral compass to her beneficent influence. Molded by her always dignified presence, Ulysses grew up with a deep, abiding respect for women, and never treated them lightly or flirtatiously. Unlike her husband, Hannah doled out praise sparingly and recoiled from anything that faintly smacked of bragging. Even when her son grew famous, a journalist noted, she not only refrained from boasting of him, but oftentimes blushed like a girl and left the room when his praises were sounded in her ears, for it seemed akin to hearing self-praise. Hating mean-spirited gossip, she regarded others charitably and shrank from spiteful comments. One day, when women in her church group groused about a drunken husband in the congregation, Hannah chimed in, "Well, Mr. A was a good fiddler, anyhow." Hannah's tendency to trust people was a lesson that her innocent son Ulysses would learn almost too well. Despite her sterling traits, something was missing in Hannah Grant, a maternal warmth whose absence Ulysses felt keenly. "I never saw my mother cry," he claimed. Deeply repressed, Hannah never bared her emotions or discussed them with her children. As she later told a reporter proudly, "We are not a demonstrative family." The Grants never showed affection openly, and a curious distance always separated Ulysses S. Grant and his mother. In his memoirs, he gave a full-blooded portrait of Jesse Grant's willful nature, but when it came to Hannah, he mentioned her maiden name, but failed to endow her with a fully rounded personality. Jesse bursts from the page, while Hannah recedes and vanishes. However infuriating Ulysses found his father, he cared deeply about his opinion. With the emotionally arid Hannah, an enigmatic silence lingered, and they had a constrained relationship in later years. This strange family background made Ulysses S. Grant a man who could seem emotionally blocked, although he freely poured forth his bottled-up feelings with his wife and children later on. When Jesse Grant planted his family in Point Pleasant, he thought the small village had a major future, but for a man of his vaulting hopes, it proved a hopelessly sleepy backwater. In August 1823, he purchased a corner lot in Georgetown, Ohio, the new county seat of adjoining Brown County, and built a two-story brick house, brick connoting wealth and standing, near the courthouse square. Jesse kept adding to the edifice during Ulysses's boyhood, since he and Hannah needed to accommodate their growing brood, soon adding Samuel Simpson, called Simpson, in 1825, Clara Rachel in 1828, Virginia Payne, Jenny, in 1832, Orville Lynch in 1835, and Mary Frances in 1839. One notes how neatly this self-disciplined couple spaced their offspring. A natural joiner, Jesse served as senior warden at Georgetown's new Masonic Lodge, while he and Hannah participated actively in the Methodist church across from their residence, often inviting visiting ministers to stay with them. A small but up-and-coming place of corn and potato farmers, Georgetown was an ideal spot for Jesse to situate his own tannery, which he placed across the street from his home. Nearby White Oak Creek furnished plentiful water, while abundant tan bark came from adjoining forests. Jesse was reputed to be a tough but fair-minded boss, a hard-working man who brooked no laziness, said a relative. One resident recalled Jesse as very shrewd in money transactions, but scrupulously honest. He was what might be called a Yankee gentleman with plenty of old-school gentility and homebred culture. The tannery, however, was a malodorous place that stank from lampblack and grease used to dress hides, and Ulysses, whose upstairs bedroom window stared out on the business, was revolted by the stench that regularly wafted across the street, a revulsion that lasted a lifetime. The boy grew up in a household that percolated with political commentary. With politics his first love, Jesse contributed to a lively newspaper called The Castigator that made its local debut in 1826. He relished controversy, publishing pungent polemical essays on a variety of topics. His literary style leaned heavily on sarcasm, and his bruising diatribes earned him a host of enemies. When disputing one opponent, he gave this self-description in a piece he signed Pluto. "Now, sir, I am a little dog and generally disposed to be peaceable, but when a big dog snarls at me, I will at least show my teeth." The paper's editor was David Ammen, a passionate abolitionist. Slavery was an incendiary topic in the town by virtue of its geography. Ohio had been the first state carved out of the old Northwest Territory, where slavery was banned by ordinance in 1787. At the same time, Georgetown stood just 10 miles from the Ohio River, where runaway slaves from Kentucky made a spirited dash for freedom, often with slave catchers in hot pursuit. So commonplace was slavery in Kentucky that bondsmen constituted 1/5 of its pre-war population. Many southern Ohio residents, originally from Kentucky and Virginia, sympathized with slave owners. It took real gumption for Jesse Grant and David Ammen to stand up to pro-slavery sentiment in this solidly democratic town. Reared in this borderland area, with the town split harshly over slavery, Ulysses S. Grant was exposed as a boy to both sides of the controversy, perhaps breeding a spirit of tolerance later evident at Appomattox. Both Jesse and Hannah Grant began as rabidly partisan Democrats who voted for Andrew Jackson. Jesse took to the pages of The Castigator to defend Jackson's veto of the charter for the Second Bank of the United States, a symbol of concentrated financial power, suggesting that only those with the hateful taint of aristocracy disputed the move. The Democratic persuasion ran so deep in Georgetown that it continued unabated during the Civil War. As Ulysses later observed, there was probably no time during the rebellion when, if the opportunity could have been afforded, it would not have voted for Jefferson Davis for President of the United States over Mr. Lincoln. For all that, the small town would enrich the Union cause with no fewer than 4 generals. Propelled by a thrusting ambition, Jesse was a persistent, if frustrated, politician, a perennial candidate who was made secretary of almost every public meeting which I attended where clerical services were required. In 1830, he ran unsuccessfully for Georgetown mayor, lost a bid for the state legislature 2 years later, then failed in his effort to become a justice of the peace. Although the hot-blooded Jesse lacked the winning charms of a candidate, he ascended to town mayor in the late 1830s. In the 1832 elections, he abandoned the Democratic Party, switching his earlier position on the bank issue and suddenly favoring its renewed charter. This sparked a heated clash with his friend Thomas Hamer, a lawyer who ran for Congress on an orthodox Jacksonian platform. a self-made man born to poor Irish parents with a thick thatch of reddish hair, Hamer had educated himself with borrowed books and risen to become Speaker of the State Legislature. In a blistering attack, Jesse wrote that Hamer cared not who sinks so as he swims. He is alike faithless in his political principles and his personal attachments. Jesse's apostasy brought their friendship to an abrupt close. Hamer's flourishing career as the leading figure in county politics would hamper Jesse's future chances in that realm. Before long, Jesse popped up at conventions for the new Whig Party, a political tradition that Ulysses absorbed as a boy. Jesse revered Henry Clay, who led the Whigs from 1834 to 1846, endorsing his American system of internal improvements, high tariffs, and a national bank, an orientation later reflected in his son's presidency. The Whigs denounced what they saw as the overweening executive power of King Andrew Jackson, selecting the Whig name to liken their struggle to that against King George III. Abraham Lincoln ventured into politics as an ardent Whig, characterizing the party as one founded to depose that detestable, ignorant, reckless, vain, and malignant tyrant, Andrew Jackson. By 1831, when William Lloyd Garrison initiated publication of The Liberator, Jesse had embraced the anti-slavery position of some Northern Whigs, even though this strained relations with many conservative townspeople and family members in Kentucky. The Whig ideology featured a strong moralistic component that doubtless resonated in the straight-laced, church-going Grant household. To strengthen the country's moral fiber, many Whigs wanted to expand the school system and favored Sabbath observance. They inveighed against the menace of alcohol, which was both a national problem. By 1830, each American drank, on average, 7 gallons of pure alcohol per year, as well as a local scourge in Brown County, which had 24 distilleries and many grape-growing sections. When the journalist Albert Richardson visited Georgetown for a biography of Grant published in 1898, he reeled at the prevalence of alcohol abuse. "To be temperate in Brown County means to be intoxicated only 2 or 3 times a year." While Jesse Root Grant has gone down in history books as a headstrong temperance advocate, there are scattered suggestions that he might have wrestled early on with his own drinking demons. One person remembered him as a low, drunken, common fellow who loves his whiskey above all else. A second said he was a Kentuckian in his liking for whiskey, while a third said Jesse would take a drink but never pay for it. Since Jesse's own father was ruined by drink, it would not have been surprising if he had championed the temperance movement as a way to conquer his own powerful temptations. Rumors of his drinking did not recur later on, suggesting that if he had a problem, he had conquered it. At first glance, there seemed something forgettable and colorless about Ulysses S. Grant in his youth. He had nothing wayward or rambunctious in his nature, and seldom wandered off into skylarking mischief with other boys. Like his mother, he was self-contained, as if he had trained his face to mask emotion and keep his inner life secret. Also like Hannah, he was uncommonly even-tempered. When he was only 2, Jesse dared a neighbor to fire a pistol near his son, sure he would take it in stride. Instead of erupting in tears, the child seemed to revel in the loud noise. "Fick it again," he cried. "Fick it again!" The incident set a lifelong pattern of Grant appearing impervious to physical danger. In respect to the boy's appearance, Jesse rendered a mixed verdict, contending that Ulysses was our most beautiful child, but I thought he did not grow up as handsome as our other boys. If his stoop-shouldered gait was inelegant, it bespoke a firm sense of purpose. He was always a steady, serious sort of boy who took everything in earnest. Even when he played, he made a business of it, Hannah recalled. One cousin remembered a short, stout boy who never talked much and stayed at home a great deal. but he had more determination than any boy I ever saw. Often, amid gangs of rowdy youths, he stood apart as if lost in thought. "He was more like a grown person than a boy," declared one school chum. As befit this seriousness, Grant gravitated to older boys, always speaking in a clear, melodious voice that later reminded the novelist William Dean Howells of the soft, rounded Ohio River accent he had heard from his steamboating uncles. Though never a smooth boy, skilled in social graces, he could be awkward and flustered in large groups, Ulysses exhibited a strict Methodist propriety. No dancing, card playing, or cursing was tolerated in the proper Grant household. "It has been a principle of mine never to swear at any time in my life," Ulysses attested in future years. Even as a raw country boy, he allowed himself no oath stronger than "thunder and lightning." Once, when quarreling with an acquaintance, he was provoked to say "darn." During the Civil War, Grant recounted this episode to someone who recalled him saying that the very sound of the word to his ears bothered him, so that for an entire week it continued to literally haunt him. He spent a lifetime avoiding the coarse jokes and bawdy anecdotes that were commonplace in the military. He revered women and thought such stories demeaned the female sex, said a cousin. I have seen him freeze up a man instantly with a look when a vulgar story was told in his presence. As part of their Methodist austerity, the Grants frowned upon liquor consumption, and not until age 11 did Ulysses steal his first forbidden taste of alcohol. Since cholera cases had appeared in town, local authorities dispatched Jesse to Maysville, Kentucky, to obtain a sweet blackberry cordial that purportedly contained medicinal qualities. When the cholera threat abated, Jesse stowed the liqueur in his cellar. When his parents went off to church, Ulysses and his friends sneaked downstairs on several occasions and gulped large quantities of the sugary spirits. Impeccably polite and usually, but not always, neatly dressed, Ulysses reflected Hannah's prim parenting. He preferred innocent pastimes such as swimming, playing marbles, or ice skating. While he delighted in fishing barefoot in summer, seated by a brook near the tannery, he seldom hunted and derived no pleasure from the casual butchering of animals. "He was unusually sensitive to pain," said a friend, "and his aversion to taking any form of life was so great that he would not hunt." Such a tame boy inevitably became the butt of mockery, and Grant grew sensitive to public humiliation. Never one to initiate a fight, he refused to back down when bullied. He was roused to fury if sadistic boys tormented an innocent child or a defenseless horse, and smaller boys embraced him as their steadfast protector. On one occasion, Grant saw a big, oafish boy named Sliffer picking on a much smaller boy. Grant stepped forward, rolled up his sleeves, and told Sliffer that he shouldn't fight that little fellow, that if there was any fighting to be done, he could fight him, said a cousin. Grant never deviated from this philosophy, which he later applied to his eldest son. "I do not want him to feel afraid to pitch in when boys impose on him, but he had better avoid boys who are inclined to quarrel." In the absence of free public schools, Jesse sent his son to a small, brick subscription school, perched on a nearby ridge, with boys and girls seated on long wooden benches and segregated in adjoining classrooms. Ulysses remembered John D. White, the village schoolmaster, as a kind-hearted and respected man, who nonetheless lashed with beechwood switches any boys who dared to misbehave. Grant already stood out for his terse expression and unruffled nature. Another teacher, Isaac Lynch, praised his quiet demeanor, studious attention to his books, and remarkably good behavior. With his bashful nature, Grant found public speaking unbearable, and only submitted to this torture by the greatest exertion. Though a conscientious student, he excelled solely in mathematics. Drawn to history and politics, he read The Life of George Washington and avidly followed the newspapers. Jesse Grant promoted literacy at home, amassing a library of 30 volumes. Regretting his own lack of education, he wanted to drum learning into his children's heads. Ulysses conveyed a vivid sense of his father's insatiable thirst for knowledge. As a boy, he had read every book he could borrow in the neighborhood where he lived. This scarcity gave him the early habit of studying everything he read, so that when he got through with a book, he knew everything in it. Jesse Grant committed the common error of willful fathers who try to stimulate their sons and overpower them instead. He doted on his eldest boy, smothering him with attention and attempting to live vicariously through him. Reluctant to assert himself against his bossy father, Ulysses quietly resented the pressure to succeed, and Jesse was perplexed that his son never seemed inclined to put himself forward at all, and was modest, retiring, and reticent. Instead of accepting this, Jesse prodded the boy mercilessly at every turn. When he took Ulysses on a trip to eastern Ohio, a telling scene unfolded, recounted by a friend. At this time, Ulysses, though young, could read very well. Of this, his father was naturally very proud, and when they arrived at their destination, to his little son's dismay, he brought out a school reader and, telling his friends of how beautifully Ulysses could read, proceeded to open his book and requested him to read something, but Ulysses declined absolutely and stuck to it, to his father's chagrin and disappointment. From this clash between grandstanding father and stubbornly private son, Ulysses developed a deeply entrenched modesty, a particular aversion to egotists and braggarts, said a later colleague. He wanted people to discover his strengths, not have them advertised. Reluctant to flout his father openly, he developed a strategy of passive resistance, retreating behind a facade of silent obstinacy. He only stood up to his father indirectly, holding back his emotions, as if fearing their violent release. Torn between an intrusive father and a painfully retiring mother, he kept a world of buried feelings locked up inside. Even at the end of his life, one of his physicians delivered this judgment on his emotional makeup. "He is the most suppressive man I ever knew. He is not devoid of emotional nature, but his emotions from early life have been diverted from their natural channels of expression. What has been called imperturbability in him is simply introversion of his feelings." The major outlet for Grant's suppressed emotions was his rapturous love of horses. Hannah noted this special affinity. "Horses seem to understand Ulysses." Somewhat clumsy in his gait, the boy was surprisingly graceful on horseback. Riding horses was an ideal way to escape from the social complexities of home into a world where he enjoyed complete freedom and didn't have to kowtow to others. He liked to ride without a saddle or stirrups, sitting astride a blanket on the horse's back, and he was so expert at handling horses that he began riding at age 5. He became known for breaking in wild horses for local farmers, a sight that drew admiring spectators to the village square. He tamed even the most refractory horses through a fine sensitivity to their nature rather than by his physical prowess. If people knew how much more they could get out of a horse by gentleness than by harshness, Grant once observed, they would save a great deal of trouble both to the horse and the man. For all his ingrained caution, the boy proved a daredevil on a horse, riding at top speed by age 5, while standing one-legged on its back. He would plant one foot on a sheepskin lashed to the animal, then maintain his balance by grasping the reins. Even when he was older and used a saddle, he had a startling way of putting his left foot in the stirrup, grabbing the horse's mane with his left hand, then swinging his body nimbly over the horse in a single, lithe, fluid motion. Perhaps no story better demonstrates his mastery of horses than Jesse's tale of when a circus came to town. "Once when Ulysses was a boy, a show came along in which there was a mischievous pony trained to go round the ring, like lightning, and he was expected to throw any boy that attempted to ride him. "Will any boy come forward and ride this pony?" shouted the ringmaster. Ulysses stepped forward and mounted the pony. The performance began. Round and round and round the ring went the pony, faster and faster, making the greatest effort to dismount the rider. But Ulysses sat as steady as if he had grown to the pony's back. Presently, out came a large monkey and sprang up behind Ulysses. The people set up a great shout of laughter, and on the pony ran. But it all produced no effect on the rider. Then the ringmaster made the monkey jump onto Ulysses' shoulders, standing with his feet on his shoulders and with his hands holding onto his hair. At this there was another and a still louder shout, but not a muscle of Ulysses' face moved. There was not a tremor of his nerves. A few more rounds and the ringmaster gave it up. He had come across a boy that the pony and the monkey both could not dismount. When it came to horses, Ulysses was quite enterprising in dreaming up money-making ventures. By age 8, he drove a team of 2 and hauled enormous logs for his father's business. On one occasion, he managed single-handedly to load giant timbers that ordinarily required a crew of 8. Jesse boasted about this episode, but a Simpson cousin noted that an aggrieved Ulysses returned from the encounter with tears in his eyes, convinced his father had imposed upon him and had not treated him with justice. 2 years later, the boy was allowed to own his own horses and had enough self-possession to transport adult passengers to Cincinnati, a distance of 40 miles. On one occasion, his livery service extended as far afield as Toledo, 250 miles distant. Another time, when he drove 2 young women back from Kentucky, they had to ford a creek swollen with rainwater, and Grant refused to be deterred. Without giving the women any warning, the 12-year-old and his team plunged into the stream, and the first thing they knew, the horses were swimming, and the water went up to their own waists, recalled Jesse. The ladies screamed in terror. In the midst of the excitement, Ulysses, who was on a forward seat, looked back to the ladies, and with an air perfectly undisturbed, merely said, "Don't speak. I will take you through safe." He deposited the 2 shaken women, soggy but safe, back in Georgetown. Money was a black art that Grant never learned to master, and he spent years trying to live down derision elicited by his bargaining for a colt at age 8. Jesse had offered a farmer named Ralston $20 for the animal. Ralston held out for $25. Jesse sent his son to haggle with Ralston, instructing him to make a $20 opening bid, followed by $22.50 if necessary, and then settle for $25 if he must. Utterly incapable of guile, Ulysses bungled the bargaining. "When I got to Mr. Ralston's house, I said to him, 'Papa says I may offer you $20 for the colt, but if you won't take that, I am to offer 22.5. And if you won't take that, to give you 25. The story circulated widely to the merriment of village youth. Grant later commented, "It cost me more heartburning than almost any transaction in life." He was so traumatized by the mockery that it remained evergreen in his memory. "Boys enjoy the misery of their companions," Grant concluded. "And in later life, I have found that all adults are not free from the peculiarity." The trusting naivete displayed in the Ralston episode would haunt the adult Grant no less than the boy. Unlike many great historical figures, Grant brooded on no vast dreams, harbored no spacious vision for his future, and would have settled for a contented small-town life. Something solitary about farming pleased him, and he was happiest when riding, plowing crops, sawing wood, or milking cows. The one business for which he was clearly unsuited was his father's tannery, which emitted a potent stench that clung to its workers. For a young man who adored animals and identified with their suffering, it was a sickening way for his father to earn a living. Inside the dreaded beam room, Jesse soaked hides in vats in a lye solution before they were removed and stripped of hairs by knives. The floor grew slimy with blood and animal fat as giant rats swarmed through the mess. One day, short of help, Jesse commandeered Ulysses for the beam room, and he was revolted by the experience. "Father, this tanning is not the kind of work I like," Ulysses explained. "I'll work at it, though, if you wish me to, until I am 21. But you may depend upon it, I'll never work a day at it after that." To his credit, instead of pushing his son, Jesse inquired what he would like to do. The boy cited three pretty pedestrian possibilities: become a farmer, become a trader, or get an education. The depth of his disgust with tanning expressed itself in his lifelong insistence on eating meat burned to a crisp and free of blood. He refused to swallow meat that swam in its own juices, an abhorrence that extended to mutton, poultry, and game. "I never could eat anything that goes on two legs," he admitted. By the time Grant reached early adolescence, his father had prospered in business and diversified his interests. Appointed an agent for the Columbus Insurance Company in 1835, he peddled fire insurance and also won a contract to build the local jail. Flush with cash, he packed Ulysses off the next autumn to an excellent private academy, Maysville Seminary, in Maysville, Kentucky, a two-story brick school on the banks of the Ohio River. Grant boarded with the widow of his rich Uncle Peter, who had thrived in tanning, salt, and river shipping. At 14, Ulysses was now a stumpy, freckled-faced, big-headed country lad. Aside from math, he remained an indifferent student. In the debating society, however, he displayed a keen interest in current affairs, especially the annexation of Texas, and in a debating club argued for the proposition that intemperance represented a more severe threat than war. After school, on warm days, he and his classmates cobbled together rafts from logs and leapt from them into the Ohio River, often swimming across and gathering fruit and mulberries on the Kentucky bank. He was always very liberal and generous in sharing anything he had with other boys, as apples, cakes, etc., said a companion. He was an exception as a boy for truth, honesty, and fairness. This idyllic period ended the next spring when the 1837 financial panic forced Jesse to economize and bring his son back to Georgetown for a year before sending him to the Presbyterian Academy in nearby Ripley, Ohio. The school was run by the Reverend John Rankin, a famous anti-slavery cleric who had emerged as an early conductor on the Underground Railroad, attaining legendary status among abolitionists. In the window of his house, set on a bluff high above the Ohio River, Rankin would kindle lamps to guide to freedom fugitive slaves from Kentucky. William Lloyd Garrison and Henry Ward Beecher credited Rankin with exceptional influence in stamping out slavery, while Harriet Beecher Stowe collected material from him for Uncle Tom's Cabin. Rankin, who said that slavery hangs like the mantle of night over our republic and shrouds its rising glories, served as minister of a nearby Presbyterian church where Ulysses Grant heard him preach many times. That Jesse shipped his son to Rankin's school suggests a possible attempt to imbue him early on with abolitionist ideals. Grant's classmates there remembered a stocky boy with a rustic air who seemed slow in speech, sluggish in movement, and careless in appearance. He was affable and well-liked, if not especially sociable, and seldom showed up at parties. He studied algebra, Latin, and math, and was inquisitive in class, though never much of a talker. That he failed to dazzle classmates with his intelligence was shown by the reaction of one to later news that Grant had been accepted at West Point. "Well, if that numbskull could pass, I know I could." By late 1838, Jesse had lost faith that his son could chart his own future and took his destiny in hand with brisk efficiency. Since the stalled economy had put a crimp in his business, he could not educate Ulysses further without withdrawing much-needed capital. It dawned on him that if the boy attended West Point, he would be schooled at government expense. At the time, many cadets avoided military careers, using the academy as a high-class vocational school specializing in math and civil engineering. Not bothering to consult Ulysses, Jesse wrote to the Ohio Senator Thomas Morris, an impassioned opponent of slavery, about a possible place at West Point for his son. The senator informed him that a vacancy existed in Jesse's district. By an extraordinary coincidence, G. Bartlett Bailey, son of Grant's near neighbor, Dr. George Bailey, had been discharged from the academy for misbehavior and/or failing exams, which his shame-ridden parents had kept secret by forbidding their son to return home, banishing him to a private military school. Ulysses thought Mrs. Bailey disclosed the secret to his mother, perhaps prompting Jesse's letter to Senator Morris. When he received the encouraging reply round Christmas, Jesse turned to his son and announced, "Ulysses, I believe you are going to receive the appointment." "What appointment?" Ulysses asked. "To West Point. I have applied for it." "But I won't go," replied Ulysses. Jesse insisted he would go, and I thought so too, if he did. As Ulysses recalled his cowed reaction to this paternal edict, the young man had little confidence he could meet the entrance requirements. "I did not believe I possessed them, and could not bear the idea of failing." It was a classic encounter between the domineering Jesse, exerting his will, and Ulysses, who lacked the strength to stand up and defy him, and sheepishly consented. The matter required a delicate next step. Jesse needed to write to his local congressman, Thomas Hamer, who had to nominate his son for West Point. There was time pressure involved. Hamer was a lame duck whose term ended March 4th. Far more worrisome was that Jesse Grant and Thomas Hamer, quondam friends, had not spoken since they parted company over Jacksonian politics when Jesse accused him of gross deceit. Ulysses later said both men, regretting the breach, wanted a rapprochement. Jesse addressed a businesslike letter to Hamer, making no allusion to past unpleasantness. It reached Hamer the night of March 3rd, and instead of being vindictive, he graciously agreed to submit Grant's name. In his haste, he listed the applicant as Ulysses S. Grant. The confusion came about either because Hamer confused Ulysses with his younger brother, Simpson, or because he assumed Ulysses was his first name and he had taken Hannah's maiden name for his middle name. Grant himself blamed Senator Morris for the long-lived error. The mistaken name, which persisted at West Point and beyond, was the bane of the young man's life and seemed symbolic of his almost comic passivity under Jesse's heavy-handed tutelage. As Grant later confessed to his wife in frank exasperation, "You know I have an S in my name and don't know what it stands for." The young Grant was right to fret about whether he would pass the exams administered once he arrived at West Point, for many would-be cadets had graduated from college or taken preparatory courses especially designed for the academy. He was not reconciled to going. "I did not want to go to West Point," he maintained. "My appointment was an accident, and my father had to use his authority to make me go." The astonishing news that Grant, the country bumpkin, was heading off to West Point elicited condescending smirks around Georgetown. One Grant peer remembered that none of us boys, high or low, rich or poor, could clearly imagine how Uncle Sam's schoolmasters were going to transform our somewhat outré-looking comrade into our beau ideal of dandyism, a West Pointer.